The president of Russia speaks out and clears up some very important points about what's next. What he said is something you should know about.
They want to halt the advance of our troops along the line of contact, thereby creating the conditions for the start of a negotiation process on terms favorable to them. That is to our adversary, but we will not give them that chance.
In other words, he's saying he's not going to let himself be goaded into a fight that would be unnecessary. He's going to stay the course on the front lines. So what's next with Russia? What's happening in the United States that will, without a doubt, affect Russia and Ukraine? This is the Sanchez Effect, and that's what we're going to be breaking down on this day. Let's do this. Hello again, everybody. I'm Rick Sanchez, and thanks so much for being among the millions of people that are checking us out every day. We certainly appreciate it. Last week, we did a segment on the war in Ukraine and how it's going and how it's being fought right now. As a matter of fact, I'm going to show it to you. Here it is. The theme of this segment that we did was Ukraine is not attacking Russia. The entire West is at war with Russia. In fact, they are attacking Russian civilians right now with drones and missile strikes. Yes, they are. And to illustrate this, we use the lines that you see me showing right there on from the U.S., from the U.K., from Germany, from France, et cetera, to show exactly where the attacks are actually coming from. This is one of about 15 segments that we put up every day, and the numbers were amazing. This segment alone on X by itself was watched or shared or commented on by more than 500,000 people. With many saying, hey, I didn't know that, or thanks for helping me understand this conflict a little bit better now. You know, that's nice. But you know who else seemed to comment on this? The president of Russia. That's right, over the weekend, Mr. Putin came out and reiterated the same message that we were sharing in that segment. It's funny to hear the president of the United States basically use your own words, right? He made it clear that he understands that it's Washington, London, Brussels, Berlin, Paris. Those are the people, those are the countries that are actually attacking Russian apartment buildings right now. Russian citizens hitting railway stations, hitting oil facilities, killing Russian civilians.
They want to halt the advance of our troops along the line of contact, thereby creating the conditions for the start of a negotiation process on terms favorable to them. That is to our adversary, but we will not give them that chance.
Yeah, you see what he's saying? They're doing this on purpose. They want to divert us. They want to distract us. Now, even though these countries, by the way, have spent more than $500 billion, let me say that again, $500 billion already to defeat Russia, so far, these countries in the West, they've still not been able to do that, at least not on the actual battlefield. So now, what are they doing, right? What are they doing? They're trying something different, a new tactic, right? And that tactic is, in a word, terrorism. It's terrorism. They're terrorizing the Russian people, or trying to terrorize the Russian people. They're trying to turn the Russian people against their government. So the Russian people will say, oh, I don't feel safe. It's your fault, Putin. It's your fault, Putin. What's the matter with you? This is an old trick. Without a new result, President Putin says he's not going to allow himself to be goaded, right? In fact, here he is talking during this interview.
Another proposal is to restrict hostilities to just four territories. That is, to conduct hostilities only in the Kherson region, the Zaporozhye region, the Donetsk People's Republic, and the Lugansk People's Republic, and in all other territories, hostilities would cease. It's also clear why, to divert our attention and our efforts away from the main objective, the final liberation of Donbass and Novorossiya.
Yeah, see what he just said right there? They're trying to stop us from fighting the war at the battlefront and get us to stop concentrating there so we go in another direction to respond to these drone attacks, et cetera. That's what he just said. Credible Western military analysts say the same thing. The ones that I've spoken to, you know, the McGregors and Ritters and these guys, they tell me, look, the Russian military needs only another 10 or 15% of the Donbass to be able to control it. And that seems to be Mr. Putin's goal. And in this interview, he explains why the West doesn't want that from happening.
It is well known that the West seeks Russia's strategic defeat. One hears occasional suggestions that they are no longer pursuing this goal. Yet the objective of inflicting a strategic defeat on Russia remains on the agenda, as no one has ever officially withdrawn that position.
So, look, if you were to come here to Moscow and you talk to Russians on the street, you'd find that they understand both historically, Russians are big on history, and strategically, that the West has always wanted to hurt them, to break up their country or destroy their country. And now the West is doing it by attacking Russian civilians to make them afraid of drones or to make their gas prices go up, which, by the way, is happening. Are people somewhat afraid of drone attacks in Russia? Of course. Who wouldn't be? Are people having to pay more for gas when refineries are hit? Yes, of course. It affects the supply. That's normal. Usually temporary. But does it make people want to take out the president of their country, President Putin? That's the West's goal, to make Russians want to get rid of Putin. Is that what's happening? No, it's not. It's not. Who the people of Russia are taking this out on is the West, which is exemplified in the number of Russians who are now volunteering to join the military. They're not being dragged to the front lines. They're saying, I want to go. I want to go. Not to mention the sheer size of the Russian economy right now, which continues to grow as citizens continue to go shopping, continue to invest, continue to go out and fill restaurants. In other words, yes, there is a frustration in Russia with the attacks on civilians as targets. But is there a panic? Is there a loss of faith in, you know, the government? No. In fact, if you look, and I have, at the latest approval numbers for President Putin, I checked just this morning, they're kind of impressive. Enviable, I would say, when you compare them to those numbers of the leaders who are actually attacking him right now. You can look this up for yourself, what I'm about to show you. But according to Western polls, even with the worst case scenario, Mr. Putin has an approval rating. Oh, I'm going to show you. Here it is. I'm going to show you Mr. Putin's number. I looked him up and I wanted to show you. Now, if you go to Statista, and by the way, Statista is a German company. That's a German company. The Germans hate Putin and hate Russia, supposedly, right? But their own polls have Mr. Putin in the 70s. Now, here's what's interesting. Polls here in Russia, state polls, have Mr. Putin somewhere in the high 60s. So at worst, he's in the high 60s. At best, he's in the high 70s. So, okay, you want to do something now? Let's take his numbers, the bad guy, according to the West, according to these leaders I'm about to show you, and compare them to the numbers from these Western leaders. Let's put those up so you can see. And we're going to start over here with my president, the president of the United States. According to The Economist, he's at 37%. 37%, far cry from 60s or 70s, right? President. Now let's go to Berlin. Look at this dude, you know, Mr. BlackRock, as I call him. The Chancellor of Germany, Mr. Friedrich Merz, he's between 18 and 20%. Emmanuel Macron, right? This is according to Statista, too, the same poll that did the Putin poll. 18%. That's a German poll. Let's skip over here. Come with me. I want to go back. I want to go to Ursula von der Leyen, right? Because she's the big, you know, the queen of the EU. She's at 23%, right? According to Ipsos. So, I mean, and this guy is gone, Keir Starmer, right? Keir Starmer, who spent a full year trying to destroy Mr. Putin, ended up destroying himself. I mean, look at this. He's at an approval of 18%, removed by his own party, removed by his own people, and it all culminated in this tearful goodbye.
And when I leave the biggest job in the country, I shall spend more time on the most important job, being the best husband I can to my fantastic wife, Vic, who has been a rock by my side through good times and bad, and being the best dad I can to my beautiful children, who are my pride and my joy. Thank you very much.
Oh, so sad. Here's a guy who tried to destroy another man, and in the process, he destroyed himself, right? How biblical. How biblical. So, look, Mr. Starmer's undoing were his own actions. It was about his statements. It was about his comportment. And good or bad, citizens should be able to judge their leaders, right? And even the leaders of other country by those measures. What's he sound like, right? What does he say? What does he do? So let me ask you this, because I think this is an important part of this conversation. When was the last time Western media allowed you, if you happen to be watching us in the West, right, in France or in the UK or in the United States or Australia or someplace like that, when was the last time they let you see or hear from Mr. Putin? When it wasn't funneled through some negative filter of he's a monster kind of thing, right? When was the last time that you saw that? Almost never, right? Never. You only see him when he's being, you know, framed as a bad guy somehow, right? I mean, this is why I think it's important to let you hear what all leaders have to say, whether he's the president of China, the president of Russia, the president of India, the prime minister of whatever, right? Whether you hate them or love them or are told to hate them or love them, you should at least be able to hear what they have to say. For example, during this interview, Mr. Putin disclosed that Ukrainian troops have been wearing stolen Russian military uniforms, and that they've just uncovered this as an attempt to infiltrate areas under Moscow's control. I think that's fascinating. That's a news story, right? Again, there's something revealed by Mr. Putin during an interview that you're never allowed to see. The Russian military, by the way, was able to discover this, and they stopped it. He also talked in this interview about Russia's energy sector. And he said that despite the setbacks from all the drone and missile attacks, to which he admits, it's generally still operating steadily.
There is some damage, but all the affected structures and facilities are being restored quite quickly, and the issues that arise are not critical in nature. Everything is operating stably and with a significant margin of safety.
Mr. Putin also addressed what he expects is going to happen after Russia completes its mission and takes control of what's left of that 10 or 15% of the Donbass I told you about, an area, by the way, that's made up primarily of Russians. Yes. The people who live in the Donbass are Russians, right? In other words, they are a people who speak Russian, who worship in Russian, who identify as Russian. How do I know this? I know this because I went there and I asked them. I looked at a group of them and said, do you identify with Ukraine? Here's how they responded. Watch.
I approached to get a better understanding of both their experience and their loyalties.
Is there anybody here who would prefer to be a citizen of Ukraine and not Russia? Russian. Russian.
My question seemed to trigger a response. It seemed almost pent up in them. Emotional. We're with Russia. With Russia. They screamed at me.
Украина гордилась, что она не лезла никакие военные конфликты. Не лезла.
Да, до 2014 года.
До 2014 года. И тут вот такое началось. У нас просто глаза на. Ну, вот это вот навязывание украинского языка. Да ну как вы можете навязывать? Мы всю жизнь разговаривали на русском языке.
На суржике, да.
У нас русскоязычно, да, поселок на суржике. Зачем навязывание вот это? Вот. Ну каждый сам понимает историю, как вот женщина сказала, да, у нас деды. У меня дед до это самое закончил войну в Японии, это самое имеет
медаль. Не имею права с флагом победы выйти. Ну, это да что ж это такое? Какой-то. Бандеру навязывают героя.
Я же говорю,
целенаправленно. Я наблюдала. вспышка и летит дрон сюда, сюда. Мы просто не знали, что там где-то институт. То есть целенаправленно. Это не могло быть ошибкой. У нас нету здесь никаких военных. Они знают, кто это наводил. Твари, сдохните. Мы уже не знаем, как... Пойдите на мир, договоритесь. Уйдите с нашего Донбасса. Это наш Донбасс, это русская земля. И мы за рус.
This is our Donbass. This is Russian land. Do you hear that? That's what she just told me. I went there and I asked the people, right? What do the people say? The people say, we want it, we're Russians, we want to be Russians, we've always been Russians. Our grandfathers, our fathers fought in wars for Russia, and that's what they say. You won't hear that in the West. You won't see that report played on CNN. See, Mr. Putin says that when those people that you just saw right there who I was talking to are liberated, and that's the word he uses, liberated, then Russia will negotiate a peace deal. He says U.S. negotiators will help Russia negotiate a peace deal. But he also told this interviewer in this report that I saw over the weekend that can't happen right now because he says the U.S. is tied up with this debacle in Iran.
Once all the events, specifically the active phase regarding the Iran track, have concluded, we expect a visit from those U.S. administration representatives with whom we have already met repeatedly in Moscow.
Mr. Putin also added some clarity to comments about past negotiations. He explained what really happened in Alaska. He said there was no real deal reached when he met with Mr. Trump there in Anchorage. But he did say that the United States offered proposals that Russia was willing to consider at the time. Of course, it all blew apart. Nothing came of it because Europe's elites freaked out when they heard about the deal. But that does not mean that something still won't come of it in the future, and it seems that's what Mr. Putin wants. Okay, when we come back, we will be breaking all of that down with Kyle Anzalone, who is the perfect guest to dissect all of this. We're going to do this with a guy not far from Boston, Massachusetts. Don't go away. We'll be right back. We're going to America. And hello again, everybody. I'm Rick Sanchez, and this is The Sanchez Effect. We continue to reach millions of people around the world. We do it in five different languages, by the way. We are happy to say, and we are most happy that you are there to join us. Also joining us now from Norton, Massachusetts. Actually, I think it's closer to Providence than it is to Boston, is Kyle Anzalone. He is the editor of the Libertarian Institute, where he hosts a show that is seen on social media platforms. It's called the Kyle Anzalone Show. Kyle, it is so nice of you to join us from America to be able to talk to us. I grew up in Miami. Are you a Boston guy?
No, I'm from the Midwest, so I'm out here after I married my wife. Her family lives out this way, so it's a little bit different being on the East Coast here, but kind of in between Boston and Providence, there's a little bit of a more laid back culture that's easier for the Midwesterners to kind of settle into.
Well, you know, I consider myself a Midwesterner as well. Even though I was born in Cuba and raised in Miami, I went and played sports, football actually, at the University of Minnesota. So my heart is in the Midwest. They are generally speaking the kindest people in America. People in Russia compare them to Siberians, interestingly enough, who also are known as the nicest, kindest, most honest people in this part of the world. So there you go. There's something about cold weather that does that to people, I guess, right?
I think so.
Hey, listen, you know, what's interesting is you as a libertarian understand the principles of libertarianism, which is it's about the people, stupid, not about the government. So maybe we should start the interview off. You're there with your analysis of what's going on in America right now. Is that the case in America right now? Is it about taking care of the people, or is the government too busy taking care of itself right now, perhaps even more than ever before?
Yeah, I definitely agree with that assessment, that there's so much corruption right now in the American government. And all of our elected officials or the appointed bureaucrats or the career bureaucrats, they're all out for themselves. They don't care about the will of the people. Every time Americans go to the polls, they elect members of Congress who say that they're going to do this and that. And no matter who gets elected, we always end up with generally the same policy where, you know, those elite connected to power in this country are getting rich. The people who want wars are getting their wars. The weapons makers are selling more and more weapons every year. But the American people get just a smaller and smaller slice of the pie.
Why is that happening? Where did we go wrong? Or do you believe, as some people think, that this whole, you know, development of a hegemony has been coming since the end of World War II, and that's where we realized that we could just get rich and to hell with the people?
I think it's been a slow, you know, wearing down of the constitutional limits that were put on particularly presidential power, but really just governmental power in general, where they now just have so much power that they don't have to respect the will of the people. I also think in the past few decades, Congress has really, and politicians in general, have figured out that it's far easier to run on a platform that demonizes the opposing candidate. So, you know, the Republicans are evil, they're racist, the Democrats are stupid, they're communists. And so you really don't have to fulfill any of your promises, because at the very least, you're keeping the evil people out of office.
You know, it's funny you say that, because one of the things that I've been noticing recently, even the people right now, for example, will use something happening right now. And that is, I give President Trump props. He's trying to get out of this stupid war. Now, you could argue it's his stupid war that he's getting us out of, but who cares? At least he's getting us out of it. Other presidents left us in places like Iraq and Afghanistan and Libya, et cetera, for, you know, tens of 20 years. So at least he's doing that. And the resistance that he's getting is coming from both sides. I hear Democrats on the left criticize him because he's doing this and he's a bad president because he doesn't know how to affect foreign policy. And I hear people on the right criticizing him as well because they want to continue the war with Iran at the behest probably of Israel. So the criticism is coming from both parties, isn't it?
Yeah, it's amazing that on some of these foreign policy issues, both the Democrats and the Republicans get together to exercise power, but that's always for more war. Here, Congress has an opportunity to help Trump get this deal done. They could start voting to remove some of the sanctions on Iran and lift some of the congressional barriers there. They could give approval for the $300 billion fund that Iran is, investment fund that Iran is asking for. There are things that Congress could do to move this deal further along. But even the Democrat members of the Senate who have voted against this war are now saying that they're not going to approve those things, and they're going to stymie Trump's effort to end this conflict. And it's because Chuck Schumer and a lot of them really do want this war. They support what's best for Israel and doing what's best for Israel, even if it's not at the benefit of the United States of America. And so now they see an opportunity to do two things, to support Israel, but also to force this war to go on and hurt Donald Trump more and more at the polls. The president finally saw a small bump in his approval rating from the floor it hit in March and April, and that's because Americans think that this war is ending, and at least prices at the gas pump are coming down. I think we were at like $4.25 at the highest, and now saw $3.85. That's just, you know, my local gas station, but at least the prices are going down for Americans, and so Trump's approval is going back up. But if this war restarts, then his approval numbers are going to plummet probably even more than before.
Let me ask you about your read on our country, my country, your country, the United States of America, and the people of the United States of America. Do you think that they've finally gotten to a point where they're truly understanding that all of these wars and all these foreign adventures that we've been led into by both Mr. Trump and the presidents that came before him are generally fruitless when it comes to them, their well-being, their children, their communities, their future? Do they finally understand that, or can they be BS'd again in the future, or are they being BS'd again right now, somehow thinking that tomorrow Iran is going to attack the United States?
Yeah, I think the American people have actually understood that these foreign interventions are not productive for them my entire adult lifetime, the past decade and a half, two decades now, since it became obvious that the war in Iraq and the war in Afghanistan were failures. That's why Obama and Trump and Biden and Trump again ran on a platform of avoiding or ending these foreign entanglements. I think what the American people have finally come to realize is it doesn't matter who you elect as president, whether it's a Democrat, Republican, whether it's the most entrenched established politician in Joe Biden was in the Senate for five decades before becoming president, former vice president, or Donald Trump, the obvious outsider, you're going to get essentially the same foreign policy. And I don't know what Americans are going to do with that information. I think we'll find that out in 2028. But maybe this really starts to force people to look at third alternatives when it comes to elections and understand that the Democrats and the Republicans are, you know, just two heads of the same dragon.
You know, and by the way, before we talk about the American people, let me ask you about that situation that you just explained. You said it doesn't matter whether it's Obama or Biden or Trump or Bush or whoever. No matter who it is, once they get there, essentially they go along to get along with these foreign adventures and these stupid wars that seem to never end and don't do anything good for the American people. So let me ask you, why does that happen? Why?
That's a good question. I wish I had a really good answer for you. I think a part of it is just to get to the point where you can become president of the United States, unless you're Donald Trump, a billionaire. You really do have to go through the vetting process to get elected at the state level and then at the congressional level. And so whoever the American people get to choose from when it comes to a general election or even a primary, I mean, typically these are handpicked candidates by the establishment who have been vetted. The people who are just put in positions of power and influence this country are put there because they hold certain viewpoints.
So it's almost like, you know, it's funny, as I'm having this conversation with you, Kyle, you know what I'm thinking about? It's almost like you and I tomorrow probably grew up kind of the same way. It would have been really cool to get a job at, I don't know, Walmart, where they made us the manager of the Walmart, you know? And, you know, it's a pretty cool job. Hey, it's a huge corporation with pretty cool benefits, and you're probably going to be paid, you know, maybe close to $100,000. So it's a pretty good gig, right? But to keep the job, they tell you, these are some things that you need to do, and you're kind of uncomfortable with those things, because they don't match your ethics or your principles. But you know what? You've got three kids at home, and you have a mortgage, and you have a wife. So what do, Kyle? You go along to get along. You tell the guys who run Walmart, fine, I'll do this. If you want to have a policy where whenever somebody who's African-American comes into the store, we're going to have one of our detectives or whatever the hell they're called, store detectives, follow them to make sure they're okay. And you're going, that's not right, but I'm going to do it because I want this job. That's the same thing we were describing, you and I, with the President of the United States. They all say they're going to stop the wars, but as soon as they get there, they get briefed by the State Department, the CIA, all these other agencies, and they tell them, this is what you're going to do, and they all end up doing it.
And tens or hundreds of thousands of unelected bureaucrats are in the same position. I mean, look at what happened during Biden's term during the genocide in Gaza, where only, what, a dozen, maybe 15 State Department or other administration officials ended up resigning over what the United States was supporting Israel doing, just murdering unbelievable numbers of Palestinians. And as we saw from the UN Commission report last week, intentionally targeting children during this time. And only 15 Americans said, oh, this is too far. I can't be on board with a government that supports it. And I'm sure a lot of them are thinking like, look, I've worked my way up. I've spent all this time in the government, lower levels. I'm finally making good money. We got this mortgage. I got three kids at home. We can't lose the house. So I just have to do this paperwork that helps to send bombs to Israel so they could slaughter more Palestinian children, because what sacrifices will I have to make in my own personal life? And, you know, when you look at the scale of the immorality, it's one thing, you know, to look the other way about an aggressive theft enforcement policy that targets a racial minority. But we're talking about wars that are wiping out thousands, tens of thousands, or in Gaza's case, probably hundreds of thousands of lives.
So that congressman or that senator or that president or that cabinet member that you just described in your scenario, he's not incentivized to care about the people of America. He's only incentivized to care about these people with special interests who visit him in his office and say, here's a check. Now make sure you do our bidding, right? What is, I mean...
Absolutely.
That means it's not a democracy.
No, it really isn't. Again, and a part of it's the primary process, right? Where no matter when you go to vote in the general elections or the, you know, congressional midterm elections, the two candidates are on the ballot. A lot of times they have very similar positions on 90% of issues. A lot of the things the government does, you know, when they have the $1 trillion military bill every year, both they're going to vote for it. They're going to vote for the wars. They're going to at least be on board with a lot of the same, even domestic and tax policies. Maybe they'll argue over like a 3% tax break for a certain bracket, but generally speaking, they agree on all these issues. So we really don't have much of a choice. And whoever does get elected is beholden to the donors who put them in that position in the first place.
So what we're literally agreeing on here is that the United States of America is not really a democratic entity, at least not right now. I know it was designed that way. I love it for its design. I love it for its constitution. I love it for the Declaration of Independence and everything else that is part of the promise. But we're nowhere near living up to that promise right now. I would argue that of the countries that I've visited just in the last year, including China and Iran and Russia and other countries in the Middle East, I would say most of those countries are more democratic than my country is right now. How's that?
I mean, there's definitely some truth to it. And there's also a lot of truth to the ideas that, you know, forget about democracy, just the ideas that were put forward in the Constitution, in particular, the Bill of Rights, that are really meant to protect the rights and the liberties of the people at large. They're respected in a lot of those countries just as much or more that they're respected in the United States of America. I mean, you know, there's books about three felonies a day, right? How everybody's just committing crimes all the time because there's all this bureaucracy. But if you're the actual victim of a crime, there's very low chances that it's going to get resolved or that you're ever going to see restitution from that, especially if you're the victim of the government.
Oh, and I'll give you another example. And, you know, I've dealt with this myself. You can go to a court, and if the judge that is deciding your case is beholden to the attorneys representing the other side because they paid for his or her ability to get elected? Yes. In America, giant law firms and giant legal corporations are allowed to, in essence, buy judges because they give them money so the judge can get elected. And then that same lawyer or lawyer representing that legal firm that gave the judge the money stands in front of the judge and says, who are you going to rule for, me or that other guy who doesn't have money and never gave you any money? Who do you think the judge is going to choose? This happens every day in the United States. Again, I ask, is that democracy?
Absolutely not.
Yeah. I mean, it's, you know, one of those things where you kind of shake your head. I know, you know, you're a libertarian. And I respect you for that because I think deep down, I'm a journalist, so I'm not here to be a Democrat or a Libertarian or a Republican or anything. I stay away from the labels. But I got to tell you, if I'm anything, I'm probably closer to being a Libertarian than anything else. Explain to our audience around the world what that means to be a Libertarian from an American perspective.
Yeah, I think the most just fundamental thing is that our rights are inherent to us as people, and they do not come from the government. It's not something that the government has to the right to take away or infringe upon in any way. So I, you know, get to worship however I want to do or not worship at all. My freedom of speech, I should be able to go on any show, say whatever I want to say, as long as I'm not directly advocating for people to take up violence against some other person to commit some particular crime. And most importantly, the right to self-defense, which means the right to bear arms, right? Like, as an individual, I need to be able to protect myself and my family, and the government should have no ability to, you know, take away my rights or to pass laws that infringe upon that either.
So the government in the United States, you feel as a libertarian, has overreached. What is the government's place? What, as a libertarian, would you argue that the government of the United States, or any government for that matter, should be doing as opposed to what they are doing?
Very minimalist. They can, you know, resolve disputes between the states of the United States of America. Some foreign policy involvement. I would love to see our country, especially being the economic powerhouse that the United States of America is, rather than going around the world and trying to resolve things through our military, but merely providing the United States of America as an unbiased and honest broker to, you know, host summits between maybe two warring African states, try to help them to find a resolution, maybe, you know, offer some investment money in either of the countries to try to, you know, boost the sides to take a deal, things like that we could do. And then running courts, having a minimal police force that, again, is really just involved in policing violent crime, and then the courts providing restitution for people who are victims of violent crime. Border security, you know, this is a country, so we do have to have some sort of border enforcement, some oversight on the people entering and leaving this country. But other than that, I'm not sure I see the government doing all too much.
So what is the people's role? What are the people supposed to be able to then decide for themselves under a libertarian system where they do it? It's not your job, government, to tell me anything about these things. We control this on our own. What are those?
I mean, then you have the right and the liberty to live your life the way you want to live it. If you decide to use drugs and waste your life and die on the street somewhere, then you could do that. But if you want to go and start a business tomorrow, the government can't stop you from doing so. There's no need to get a business license. If you have a product or a service that somebody else is willing to pay money for, then you could provide that product or service to that person without any oversight, any interference from the government. You know, the government could maybe collect a tariff on importing products, and then in that way have some funding to do the basic functions they need to do, but they're not taxing individual Americans. Whatever that guy pays you, you get to keep 100% of it. And then I do think if that situation occurs, we do need to have some responsibility for our fellow Americans. There's not going to be welfare, food stamp programs in a libertarian society. So we have to make sure that our communities have, you know, just privately run programs, charities, to have food banks. And there are plenty of private food banks in the United States of America. But, you know, these kinds of things are really going to have to increase in volume to make sure that people aren't starving, that children are clothed and gain education, things like that.
But is it okay for the people to come together and come up with some kind of Social Security plan so that when we all get older and in our 80s or 90s or whatever, that we're kind of taken care of and that there's something there for us if we don't have any family members left? Is that okay from a libertarian perspective?
In the sense of private charity, I think an actual Social Security program that we have now, where the government just takes the money out of your paycheck and forces you to invest in it, is not within libertarian principles.
It's not?
No.
So how would you, under libertarian principles, take care of us all when we get older?
Yeah, Ron Paul has made this point, one of the, you know, more important libertarian thinkers in the United States.
Yeah,
that,
I know.
You know, before there was the, you know, government-run healthcare system in the United States of America, where there's Medicare and Medicaid, hospitals, Catholic hospitals, just treated everyone whether they could pay or not. And so there would be similar institutions set up. And I'm sure if you, you know, invested your money wisely through your life, you're going to live in a nicer retirement community than one that's provided through some private charity. But there are going to be private charities that exist, because I think generally as a people, we would be disgusted seeing elderly, you know, just dying on the streets because they can't afford to live in their houses anymore. Also, when you strip away things like property taxes and things like that, it's going to become much easier for older people to take care of themselves once they stop working, because there's not going to be all these taxes that continue to hit them year after year after year, even when they stop working.
You mentioned Ron Paul. He and I have had lots of great conversations. In fact, he's asked me to speak at his annual conference, which I did, and I've gotten to know him. And I know the one pet peeve of Ron Paul's has always been the Fed and the debt and taxes. Even people who are not libertarians have now all come to a general agreement that the United States is out of control on all three of those issues. Can you put that in perspective for our viewers?
Yeah, the Federal Reserve is this massive bank that just creates money and then gives it out to banks to where they then lend it out at a higher interest rate than they're paying the Fed. So it's a guarantee that all these banks that have assets to the Fed funding just get essentially to make free money by taking money and lending it out at a higher interest rate than they're getting it, which is rather absurd. From you know my perspective, I focus on the anti-war stuff most of all, that the Federal Reserve allows the United States government to wage wars, to have a $1.5 trillion military budget without actually taxing the American people at the rate that's needed to fund these wars and to fund this massive military. And so it really allows the U.S. government to hide the true cost of these wars to the American people, which they only then later experience through inflation, which is the hidden tax, where the government has to borrow all this money, continue to borrow money just to pay down the debt from, like, you know, these wars that's just building up and building up. We don't realize that that's part of the reason why eggs are now $5-6 a dozen rather than 99 cents, which I remember from when I was a kid.
And speaking of wars, finally, let's talk a little bit about the news. The news is that Mr. Trump says that they're going to have a meeting tomorrow in Doha. The Iranians are saying, not true, we haven't scheduled any meeting with the Americans. Meanwhile, over the weekend, there were several skirmishes. The Iranians shot at a cargo ship with a Singaporean flag. The Americans then hit a couple of deep missile depots in Iran. Do you have a feeling that this thing is finally going to get settled? And if not, why not?
I don't think it's going to finally get settled here. I think there's two things happening. One, J.D. Vance is leading this diplomatic track with the Iranians. They've established this memorandum of understanding, which really is negotiations based on the framework proposed by the Iranians. So that means the U.S. is making a lot of concessions to the Iranians, particularly on the Strait of Hormuz in Lebanon. When you look at the Strait of Hormuz, the U.S. Effectively agreed that Iran is going to control that. They agree not to impose tolls or fees, but that's only for 60 days. Now, Marco Rubio, the Secretary of State, is doing something else. He's going to the Middle East. He met with the foreign ministers of the GCC nations. This includes Oman, Qatar, Saudi Arabia.
Yeah.
And they all agreed that Iran would not be allowed to charge tolls in the Strait of Hormuz. And then Oman announced there was a new shipping lane opening up through Omani territory that would never have fees. And the Iranians attach ships using that lane because they say, and it does violate the memorandum of understanding. And this led to kind of tit-for-tat strikes between the U.S. and Iran over the weekend. The U.S. hit some Iranian islands and some other positions. The Iranians say they hit, I think, 8 U.S. military facilities across the region. So I think what we have to understand is there's Marco Rubio and J.D. Vance, and one of these two men is going to be doing what the president wants. And I think that's Marco Rubio, where the negotiations are actually a ruse. They're just trying to buy some time. And Rubio's making sure that this war doesn't actually get ended and creates a pretext to ramp it back up. And that's the path that we're currently headed down.
And Rubio's a hawk, and J.D. Vance is not. J.D. Vance wants to stay out of forever wars. Marco Rubio thinks forever wars are the coolest thing in the world, especially if they're at the behest of Israel. Israel has been giving him money for the last 20 years, which has propped him up and put him in the position he's in. So if you choose a winner here, you know who's backing them, right?
Yes. Yeah. And I think, again, I think Rubio is going to prevail. I mean, maybe
so Israel
these negotiations
prevails.
Are more
Rubio,
serious, but
Rubio is, prevails, Israel. Israel prevails, right? I mean, pardon me right. for interrupting you, but I just kind of wanted to cut to the chase there. Please.
No, that's the exact point, yeah, that Israel gets what they want by the U.S. going back to war with Iran. Then they don't have to agree to the ceasefire in Lebanon, and they just continue to eat up Israeli Lebanese territory.
But, you know, there's a lot of people out there who disagree with you. They think this is a final moment for Israel, where they're finally, they've gone too far. They are, as J.D. Vance said, the most hated country in the world. They only have one ally, and it's the United States. And this is not going to be a good ending for them. You disagree. You think in the end they'll be back to controlling everything in the Middle East.
In the short term, at least, that the United States does end up going back to war with Iran and tensions flare higher. But that doesn't change the strategic wins that Iran has netted during this war. And I don't see a scenario, unless the U.S. or Israel are willing to use nuclear weapons, that's going to change Iran's strategic ends. And once this war does end and negotiations do happen, then Israel will have had a major setback in the Middle East. And I do think this war is costing them a lot of support in the United States of America. And that might reach a critical mass where it actually does have some impact on U.S. policy in the years going forward. But in the short term, I think if you look at what happened over the past year, where the U.S. and Iran were engaged in what were thought to be serious negotiations twice, and then the U.S. or Israel attacked Iran in the middle of those negotiations, I don't see any reason to believe that won't happen again here.
Well, I guess we have to put our faith on either Mr. Trump or Mr. Vance, and both of them seem to be figuring this out correctly right now. But, you know, Kyle, time will tell, right? You have been an absolute delight to talk to, my friend. I really enjoyed the engagement and the conversation and your wisdom on the whole idea of how politics can and should work in America. Unfortunately, we're kind of far from it right now. Please tell our viewers around the world where they can find you if they want to be able to contact you or watch you on the Talking Box.
My show is The Kyle Anzalone Show. I also do the news at the Libertarian Institute and the Viewpoint section at antiwar.com.
You're a good man. Thanks, my friend. So nice of you to be able to spend some time with us. Thank you for being so generous with your time. Well, that's it for this segment. Reminder that you can usually find us as well. We're on Spotify, we're on X, and we're on YouTube when YouTube's not canceling me or my segments. By the way, did you know that social media platforms answer, like YouTube, they answer to advertisers, they answer to processors who decide what you are allowed to read, what you're allowed to hear, or what you're allowed to say? That's terrible. But it's pretty much what they do. YouTube is probably the worst of all of them. They recently canceled my 120,000 followers. Why? Because they could. They own it, not me. I thought I owned it. I thought it was my channel. No, it's their channel. So let me tell you about something else. I want to tell you about BitChute. They really are different. That's why I believe in BitChute. That's my page right there. And I want to see if I can get them started, get them, you know, off the chute, sort of speak. You know, they answer to you. BitChute doesn't answer to advertisers or algorithms. They answer to you. No one is removed. Content never disappears. BitChute. You know, I'm going to do my live stream on BitChute at 1 p.m. Miami time. That's what, about a half hour from now, right? It's where I interview Scott Ritter and Professor Morandi and Larry Johnson and Tucker Carlson. Look for it. BitChute. Check them out. And I'll see you there right after the show. 1 p.m. Miami time. Did I get that right? Yes, I did. All right. Now, we want to thank you for being with us. It's really important that we have these kind of conversations like the one that I just had moments ago with Kyle. And thank you, most of all, as we always like to say, for letting us into your home. And we'll be looking for you next time. I'm Rick Sanchez. Good night.